Good day. Welcome to Intercultural Yoga. My name is Raymond Reyes, and I'm currently serving as the Associate Provost and Chief Diversity Officer at Gonzaga University. I've been here for 32 years. Originally came as a professor in the School of Education, and now serving the institution in this area of our mission. What I want to talk a little bit about right now is the inaugural launching of this program called Intercultural Yoga. The reason why I've thought about using this phrase is in my life I've realized that when I'm stretched and I'm challenged is when I grow. As I often said, if I'm a fat rock on I'm a fat snake on a hot rock, I have no intrinsic or intrinsic motivation to move. What moves me usually is when things get my attention emotionally, psychologically, or spiritually, or physically. In this case, the intercultural encounter is something that the Jesuits have been known about for 482 years. Now there's 19,000 Jesuits in 112 countries. And the intercultural encounter has been one where they have seen how God works through others in human culture. In this instance, in this time that we're living right now, especially with what has happened on the 25th of May in Minnesota with our fallen brother, George Floyd, that reminds us once again that human difference is a challenge and an opportunity. And this program is designed to stretch people, to get them out of their comfort zones, and be able to create some cognitive dissonance where they have to reconcile what they thought they knew with emerging new experiences. And I'm here today with a dear colleague and friend, a friend I hope I can call a friend that I've just recently met this past January. This is Dr. Manuel Gomez. He came to us in January serving as an interim vice provost for student affairs. I'm sad to say that he'll be leaving us shortly. I'm going to really miss him. One of the things about Dr. Gomez that you don't know is that he's a seasoned veteran of higher education. He served as a vice chancellor and was in the University of California Irvine system for 38 years. We are fortunate to have him here over the last couple of months. One of the things that and I know you're going to help me flesh out the meaning of intercultural yoga, this idea of stretching and breathing into other parts of our consciousness, other parts of our being that we've never experienced before to grow and evolve. But I know you as a poet, and I often have talked about how bell hooks thinks about the role of a poet in society. And how she says that the poet does three things across time and space and human cultures and historical as well as contemporary. And that is the poet confronts the hard issues, speaks the unspeakable, speaks truth to the face of power. And the second thing that a poet does is it creates robust conversation. It allows people to talk about things in creative, new, imaginative ways. And the third and final thing is because poetry comes out of the creative imagination to celebrate the human spirit. The human ability to be resilient, to learn from experience, and be creative. It's an interpretation of what is happening. So today what I would like to do, Manuel, is just have a conversation with you about this idea of intercultural yoga. And then I have, of course, some questions I want to ask you, because I'm really interested always in the intersectionality of the power of one to the many. How does a leader do what a leader does, given how their identity informs their leadership in terms of serving the common good?
Oh, great, Ray. I just want to thank you, Ray, for this invitation to your inaugural intercultural yoga program. I feel very honored, and particularly intrigued. Prior to talking to you a little bit about intercultural yoga and its meaning to me, I'd like to give thanks to you, but I also would like to give thanks to the indigenous spirits that still animate this land, the rivers, the lakes, the trees, and the sky. Their spirit remains, and I want to give thanks to that spirit as well. But the term intercultural yoga intrigued me immediately the minute I learned about your program. Of course, yoga means union. It's a Sanskrit term, which is a 5,000-year tradition out of India, which is not what we understand yoga to be in the West. In the West, it's a workout, it's secularized, yeah, and it's for profit. But yoga, in its original practice, is actually a quest for mental and physical harmony with the environment. very similar to the indigenous perception of education, and in many respects, very similar to the Ignatian ideal of education. I want to talk a little bit about those dimensions in my experience of education with regard to GU, indigenous education, and your term of yoga. But if you don't mind, because this moment is so pregnant with potential for a true transformation in our nation and our culture, with this generation, which have just had it, you're very fortunate to initiate your program right now, because in my mind, the wheel of time is turning, and it's turning towards us now. 500 years have passed since 1521, when Hernando Cortes conquered the Aztec Empire in the Valley of Tenochtitlan. He arrived in 1519. The conquest took 3 years. So we're right now, the wheel is turning. 500 years have passed of colonization, genocide, death, destruction, and racism. And on May 25th, 2020, that wheel took a big turn in our consciousness with all the people outraged at the brutal murder of George Floyd right in front of our eyes on May 25th in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'd like to, if you allow me, to dedicate a poem in your inaugural program to George Floyd to commemorate the moment.
Please, do so.
In the old days, the stench of sin filled God's nostrils. He could taste it. She could smell it. Today, like the past, this racism smell stinks. Instead of a rope tree letting you know you are not free, white man strangles you with a hateful taste of his knee, pressing down on your neck until you can breathe no more. This strange and bitter fruit lies in the middle of the street on this stifling afternoon. Death seems like such an unreachable distance. Yet we know George Floyd is right now breathing in eternity. I wonder if the policeman who casually killed him and chose not to listen can hear him now. That poem came to me as I participated and observed and felt this turning of the wheel, the move towards a higher consciousness, a unity of all of us as one family, one humanity. That's what you see right now in all the cities across this country and around the world. It was a transitional point. Now the work begins for the real restructuring and the path that we might want to take. And it begins, in my estimation, in many respects, with education.
Right. I agree with you. I think that I know that May the 25th was a huge wake-up call. Carl Rogers once said that what we forget, we always are. What we remember, we can change. These hate crimes and these incidents that continue to occur, and then we go back to sleep. We go back to the trance, the consensus reality, to maintain the status quo. In this sense, 2 years out, 2 weeks out, maybe 2 years from now, hopefully they'll still have the same intensity to sustain the commitment to create change. And so the wake-up call was May the 25th, and I think that we're uniquely positioned now with this, first the pandemic, first the virus and what happened there, and how that affected people's lives, but now the racism pandemic that we're dealing with once and for all, and hopefully we won't go back to sleep. Well, one of the things I'm interested in is always about how these experiences affect people and change people, or how they reinforce what a person is about. So one of the things I'm interested in right now is, I know you came temporarily to Spokane to serve as vice provost, and you have been sheltered in for months now by yourself. And then now, secondly, as you said, the sacrifice that George Floyd has given to keep us awake and vigilant to what we need to be about. But I'm wondering, as you've experienced the last couple of months, and particularly the last 2 weeks, What one or two qualities have you got in touch with that tell you that without those qualities you would not be you? It's one of these essence questions about how are you you and called to serve in the world the way you do?
Well, in some respects, I think that my sense of spirituality, my identity, my sense of who I am in the world is rooted in my experiences with conflict, with racism, with this culture that always looked at you askance, right? The word dirty often accompanied what I am, a Mexican-American, as an adjective, right? It was common. I'm 73 years old, so I've lived through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and now we're into the second decade of the 21st century. So my experience is traveled a social distance that is so immense that it goes beyond 73 years in terms of the shifts and changes that have occurred. I have a compulsion to do good, to want to make a better world. In many respects, but we forget about it, like you just said. Let me share a story with you. I have a friend who's a professor in Sacramento. He's a community college professor. His daughter is 7 years old. And every day, his daughter would watch him go to work and all that. And one day, he blew up so proud because his daughter finally, at 7 years old, asked him, "Daddy, what do you do?" And he said, "Wow, Laura, I teach students at the community colleges." "Oh, God, Dad, that's great. What do you teach them?" "I teach them how to draw." And the little girl's jaw just drops. And the father's a little concerned. And she says, "You mean they forget?" We forget a lot more than how to draw. Yeah. In fact, education, unfortunately, in many respects, takes us outside of ourselves instead of inside of ourselves. And so we begin to forget who we are. Yeah. And we begin to not even understand our emotions, because school, in many respects, gets us lost. We instead of following the Socratic dictum of knowing oneself. Now, what I want to say about this is that this relates to our earlier comment about yoga and how it is an indigenous practice in India, mm-hmm. for a quest to be in harmony with oneself. It's not just stretching your neck, it's stretching your soul, mm-hmm. it's stretching your spirit, and becoming more in harmony with the world. In indigenous education, at least in my estimation, education doesn't happen outside, it happens inside. That's more or less the indigenous difference with Western difference. To the indigenous, education is not a piece of paper. It's not a commodity. It's a living, learning process. Nature is our classroom. We talk and work and learn with each other in a circle, not in a square, not a rectangle. We move to an understanding of ourselves in harmony with our ecological reality. We have an identity in relationship with the land. The spirit of the land teaches us, the spirit of the rivers, the sky. We have a connection to the land in terms of how the indigenous perspective of education is distinct from what happens in the Western world. Now, this is the other leap I want to make. Gonzaga University, the Ignatian ideal of education is not so distant from what I've just been talking about. As a matter of fact, in my view, the ultimate purpose of the Ignatian pedagogical ideal is, of course, to develop a human being with intellectual competence, mm-hmm. with moral authority, and caring compassion to be able to pursue social justice in the world, to be able to relate and know who one is and stand up in one's truth with one's own limitations. And the final, ultimate goal of the Ignatian ideal is to act out of love.
So let's talk a little bit about that. As you speak and talk about education and the important role of education in intercultural fluency development, or to become, what does it mean to become fully human?
Right.
James Baldwin, he once said that education is really a disturber of the peace, that it's there to interrupt the status quo, that it's there to get people to question what they assume and reconcile any cognitive dissonance between what they thought they knew and now new emerging information. One of the things that I struggled with 2 weeks ago initially with George Floyd's passing was this tension between, should I say something or not? Should I say something? Because if I don't say something, then silence is endorsement. But then there's another part of me that this is more than a job. From cradle to grave, this has been my life journey, this issue of justice related to inclusion and equity. So then the other part of me was saying, I'm tired. I'm tired of just talking. I want to act. So one of the things I want to explore with you right now in greater depth, because I know you have experiences in this as a young man and your experiences with resisting the Vietnam War, is I really want to probe deep into fully understanding the nature of change. Because of this tension around, on one hand, we've got to talk about it, we've got to claim it. On the other hand, how do we transform as an alchemist rhetoric into reality? How do things change? What needs to change? Where are there instances when things have changed and succeeded in doing so? And this is my struggle, is I'm tired of talk. And I think a lot of other people want action. So understanding how do things change, and very quickly what I want to address is something that I shared with recently with a group of people. And that is some of my consulting work that I did on the North Slope in Alaska back in the 1980s. And I went up to Barrow, Alaska, which is way up on the most northern tip, 600 miles from true North Pole, right? Where the hottest it gets in summer, the hottest, highest temperature, 38 degrees. I mean, it's a magical, incredible place, and the indigenous people are whaling society people, okay? The reason why I'm telling you this is it goes back to this whole idea of I have a restless curiosity about how things change, and how do you mobilize rhetoric and reality? So this is what the whaling people were experiencing up there. The conditions were changing. The conditions were changing because of global warming. The permafrost was melting. And as the conditions were changing because of the temperature, the climate began to change. And as the climate began to change, the culture had to do an adaptive response. Right. So this interesting, intimate interplay and relationship between change the conditions, change reality. Change the conditions, change the climate. Change the climate, you change the culture. So in this nation state called America, the United States of America, You know, thinking about United States of consciousness, diversity, the idea of e pluribus unum, out of the many one, that we all agree whether we're conservative or liberal, whether we're male or female, whether we're gay or lesbian or heterosexual, whether we're a person of color or white majority. Everything under the sun that makes us difference, we agree on one thing, freedom. We all have a love affair with freedom. And a friend of mine once said that on the East Coast we have a Statue of Liberty, on the West Coast we ought to have a Statue of Responsibility. So my question to you is, we reflect upon what has just occurred in our lives. In the call to judge each other in our accountability to act and contribute to something meaningful to create change in society.
You mentioned James Baldwin and quoted him. One of my favorite quotes from James Baldwin is, not everything faced can change, but nothing can change unless faced. So the first rule of any change is you have to face the reality. We have to face our current reality of police brutality in our daily lives and for hundreds of years. The second thing, though, is time. And then the third thing, I think, is leadership. There is that individual, and in this case, George Floyd is an individual who has galvanized the entire world into one laser focus of racial violence, the brutal legacy of the last 500 years was revealed in that moment before the world, watching the knee of a badged, gun-toting state officer sworn to protect the lives of the person that he's killing. I have such admiration, and we shouldn't talk too much about it, but that 13-year-old girl that did the video, gladly they've kept her anonymous, but she signifies to me the beginning, the fourth stage of change. The young generation sees the world differently, and the consciousness changes. They have changed the consciousness. If you look at the LGBT movement, the rapidity of change that occurred, well, it wasn't that rapid, but it appeared to be because the moment arrived, right, and the dominoes began to fall, or cascades of change, like a flowing waterfall, started coming and coming. Like in the moment we're in now, we're in the 16th day of nonstop day and night curfew violating peaceful protests calling for change. So the change does come with struggle. It does come dragging people who do not want to change. It does come with an undoing of privilege of the old status quo and a realignment of our more harmonious relationships. It does come with love and spirituality. If there is no spiritual dimension, we can't go too far on anger. We can get a distance, but it doesn't go that far. I can share with you, I mean, I began my work as an activist, literally, when I was 20 years old. And I quit the university for 3 years because I worked combating numerous police brutality, actually police killings is what they were. They weren't brutality. They killed a bunch of individual Chicanos at will in all the barrios across the Southwest in 1968 through 1970. I was in Texas. I was in New Mexico. I was in Arizona. I was in LA. I was in Orange County. I was in San Joaquin Valley. I became like a professional organizer trying to bring justice for unjust killing of a Chicano male. Mm-hmm. And I learned a great deal about the, I don't want to get too emotional here, but the fear and protection racket run by this blue badged gang and all the city councils that are dominated by these police department unions that basically have carried out the legacy of white supremacy and colonialism in our communities. It's just now clear and in the glaring light of our reality. You mentioned the COVID-19 is another interesting change. Like you talked about the melting of the permafrost. And now we're talking about a biological virus that has brought everybody together into their own homes and had to face each other. And they have nothing else to do, so they're watching the world on TV. And so millions more people than probably would have done it saw right there in front of our eyes for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. A man with no mercy, avoiding the pleas of witnesses, avoiding the pleas of the victim himself, who turned to the courtesy of, "Please, officer, please, sir, I can't breathe, please, officer," and who underneath his knee called for his mama, called for his mama. If that event didn't immediately change your consciousness of what the world is about and the reality of our police community relationships, nothing will. That did it. And now the moment of a mass movement is the next. And interestingly about this movement, it has no national leaders. No one person heading up this thing that can be busted or messed up. Right. This is almost a spontaneous
grassroots
uprising. Now, we've had disappointments in the past. I don't know you recall the massive demonstrations prior to the invasion of Iraq and the entire world. That,
right.
In fact, it was so massive, we thought he was going to stop. How could you go against the entire world? All the capitals of the world were just loaded with people, and we had a moment of hope that maybe it would work, but it didn't. So the reason I raise that issue is, of course, we can have a short circuit of this process that's unfolding. I don't know if you wanted to hear when I was a young man, I was 20 years old, and what I'll show you is how my mind and perspective was as an activist in 1969, that's over 50 years ago, oh, right?
Yes.
So I'll just read a couple of paragraphs, okay, if you don't mind. This is a letter that I distributed in Oakland, California, when I resisted induction into the armed forces because I refused to fight in the Vietnam War as a peaceful pacifist under the Catholic Church, who gave me the clearing. And I had a 4-H deferment on my spiritual, conscientious objector deferment that was taken away from me because of my activism. And then I had to resist. And I had three choices. I could run away to Canada.
Yeah.
I could maybe go to Mexico. Mm-hmm. Or I could go underground. Or I could stand trial. I chose to go to the trial. By fortune, good fortune, the war had turned after a while, and the Nixon administration decided not to put the war on trial with a whole bunch of individuals like myself. The last thing I want to share about that is that every year that passed afterwards, because we're talking about change, when I first took that step, I was trembling. I was a really difficult step to possibly ruin your whole life in terms of jail or this thing. And the reverse happened. After I took the action, every year that passed, I got stronger and stronger in my position instead of weaker. Mm-hmm. So change takes place by taking the step, and I took the step. In 1969, I wrote this letter. I said, today, December 8th, 1969, I must refuse induction into the armed services of the United States. Please understand, it is difficult for me to communicate my feelings through writing, but nevertheless, I will try to let you see through my window. In my veins runs the blood of all the people of all the world. I am a son of La Raza, the universal children, and cannot be trained and ordered to kill my brother. For my people, I refuse to respect your induction papers. It is well known that Mexicans were among the first victims of your empire. The memory of the Mexican-American War is still an open wound in the souls of my people. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo is a lie, similar to all the treaties signed with our Indian brothers and sisters of the Southwest. Strife has never stopped. My people have known nothing but racist tyranny and brutal oppression from this society. Your educational system has butchered our minds, stung our hearts, and poisoned our souls. You cut out our tongue and corrupted our culture, making us strangers in our own land. And the sweat of my people have watered your fields, and their aching bones harvested your food. And in the short time that you have held the land, we have seen the pain of seeing beautiful lands turned into parking lots and freeways, of seeing the birds disappear, the fish die, and the waters become undrinkable. Seeing the sign private property hung on a fence surrounding lands once held in common, and having our mountains become but vague shadows behind a veil of choking smog. Your judges, armed with a cold sword called law, held in the diseased arm of justice, have frozen the life of my brothers in your barbaric prisons, scarring them deeply.
Well, one of the things that I want to explore deeper with, and you touched on it, and you've just modeled and embodied the practice, and that is facing the truth, that nothing can change, going back to James Baldwin, not everything that you face changes, but nothing can change until you face it.
Exactly.
And I know that recently, one of our Board of Trustees members, Dr. Ed Taylor, wrote an editorial in the Seattle newspaper, and part of his message was talking about what is it going to take for us to move from this moment as an opportunity to change. And he talked about the truth and reconciliation process, and that he's talked about first facing the truth, the reconciliation, and then the repair, reparations, repair, right, the right, healing right. that needs to happen. And so, you know, I think for another time, I really want to talk about practical next steps that people can take to contribute towards facing the truth, taking individual responsibility for facing the truth, and then how do we reconcile? Because I think Desmond Tutu, and he spoke here a number of years ago as a convention speaker, I'll always remember, you know, the title of his book, There Is No Future Without Forgiveness. Not to forget, but to forgive.
Right.
And I think that we're uniquely positioned right now in this moment, given the two pandemics, the viral pandemic and then the racist pandemic, that we're been gifted with an invitation to really face the truth, look in the mirror, and be able to reconcile who we want to be versus who we really are, the creative tension between the ideal and the real, and then be able to say, how do we heal and repair this? How do we begin to agree to disagree with civility and respect? How can we hold the common ground in diverse ways? You know, there's almost this creative tension around know the similarities, understand the differences. Don't allow the universality of homogeneity to take over, but yet don't differentiate to the extreme where heterogeneity and diversity is divisive. So how do you bring a unified field of being in terms of difference and similarity? And that we live in a binary world, and how do we transcend that? And I think going back to yoga, as we stretch ourselves out of this moment, in this program, that we're given an opportunity to create a different spiritual exercise about our belief systems and how that informs behavior in relationships. Someone once told me in closing that everything is a bundle of potential waiting to be activated in human relationship. And the intercultural relationship is probably the most intense moment of human beings coming together, heart, minds, and souls for a greater good, despite their individual preferences. So how do you negotiate the creative tension between the I and the we? And with that, I want to thank you for our time together, and hopefully we have another opportunity to continue this conversation, because I think, as Father Tony once said, Gonzaga, to be continued. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray.